Hey, you guys. Time once again for the movie retrospective. And again, Tom didn't get a chance to watch this movie like before I had to do the recording. So I'm going to fly solo on this one again. Hopefully nobody minds all that much. So, Italy. Although I will say that this reputation that they have is sometimes not justified. I mean, because Italy obviously had, you know, is pretty well known for its many excellent original contributions to the art of world cinema. But, you know, you have to admit Italy did have a bit of a reputation during the 1970s and 1980s for making kind of cheap knockoffs of pretty much any American movie that was, you know, in any way financially successful. Like, you know, Jaws came out, and then Italy comes out with Great White, which is also called The Last Shark. You know, for every Star Wars, there was a Star Odyssey. For every Raiders of the Lost Ark, there was Ark of the Sun God. You know what I mean? Like, every time something big would come out, like, they would do their own take on it. So, because William Friedkin's The Exorcist was such a huge smash hit and a huge cultural phenomenon also back in 1973, you knew it wasn't going to be all that long before a so-called spaghetti version of it would turn up in theaters. And lo and behold, 1974 brings us the Italian-American co-production Beyond the Door. Now, in Italy, this was actually released as Chi Sei, I think is how you pronounce it, which just means who are you, which will make sense when you see the movie. Now, since this movie features kind of possession by a foul-mouthed demon, a bit of poltergeist activity, 180-degree head rotations, and a whole bunch of green vomit, Beyond the Door was actually deemed so similar to The Exorcist that Warner Brothers sued the, you know, filmmakers, and they actually won a settlement, and that settlement entitled them to, I don't know how much cash they got, like they got some kind of undisclosed cash sum, and they also got a percentage of any future revenue that the movie would bring in. And despite its kind of dubious pedigree, I guess, Beyond the Door did rake in a pretty tidy profit at the American box office. It only cost $350,000 to make, you know, more or less, and pulled in about $15 million, which is pretty crazy. And I will say, too, that, like, calling Beyond the Door just, like, an Exorcist knockoff isn't entirely fair. I mean, yes, the film's narrative does borrow very heavily from William Friedkin's film, but it isn't exactly the same story, and it kind of comes up with some interesting ideas and maybe, like, even some subversions of the genre, like, of its own. Now, I will say, my main criticism, I think, is that the movie is, like, probably way longer than it needs to be. Like, I watched the international cut, which is actually on Plex, and it was an hour, and I believe it was an hour and 47 minutes long. Now, the original U.S. theatrical cut was only 97 minutes, and I haven't seen that version, but I'm kind of feeling like maybe that would be better, depending on what it was that was taken out, because the movie being an hour and 47 minutes long, like, some of the sequences do drag on, like, way longer than they needed to and kind of repeat the same information unnecessarily, and some of the dialogue is, like, very repetitive. On the whole, though, I kind of feel like Beyond the Door is just this very weirdly compelling experiment, I guess, like, in its own right. It's a weird-ass movie, for sure, but there was something about it that was, like, really appealing. I know it won't appeal to everybody, because I feel like this gets almost, you know, universally, like, negative reviews, but there was something about the vibe of it that actually I kind of liked and enjoyed, even though I did think it, like I said, that I dragged in places. But, I mean, it has, I don't know, it just has, like, all these really weird elements to it that I enjoyed. It had, like, these kind of, like, really weird, like, musical cues, had some really nice, like, cinematography, like, very nice, like, use of light and shadow, very dramatic in places, and a couple of scenes and images in there that are actually, like, pretty genuinely creepy. So this was directed by two guys. Like, the first guy, his name is Ovidio G. Asonitis, and yes, you may suppress your giggles now, because I was like, Asonitis, come on. That sounds like, get some preparation on that, but I'm sorry, preparation H on that. So Asonitis and the other guy, Roberto Piazzoli, and those are the same two guys that also collaborated, incidentally, on another Jaws ripoff, which was called Tentacles, which came out in 1977, which is about a killer octopus. So those two guys directed it. Beyond the Door was actually successful enough that Film Ventures International, who's, like, the releasing company, initially wanted to release the kind of Mario Bava classic from 1977 called Shock in the United States as Beyond the Door 2, even though it doesn't have anything at all to do with the original film. I think there's like one actor that overlaps and obviously doesn't play the same part. But yeah, nothing to do with the original film. But that's kind of what they did, you know what I mean? There was also a third installment in 1989, which of course was called Beyond the Door 3, which also had fuck all to do with the original movie. It actually went straight to VHS. Now, Mr. Asinitis... I can't. I'm 12 years old. I'm sorry. I know that's like, it's probably not funny, like in the other language. But he actually like announced in 2021, like just last year, that he was working on an actual honest to God sequel to Beyond the Door, which would actually feature Juliette Mills from the original movie. But we'll see if that ever materializes. Like on Wikipedia, it says that it's supposed to be out in 2023, but we'll see. So anyway, at the beginning of the movie, we have a voiceover from someone who is presumably the devil. Being devilish and whatnot. So on the screen, there's like this kind of whole occult ritual deal thing going on. And we see like a nude woman stretched on a pentagram who is eventually helped to escape whatever her fate was going to be, sacrifice, I'm presuming, by a man named Dimitri. Now, Dimitri is played by Richard Johnson, who horror fans will immediately recognize as Dr. Mark Way from the 1963 movie The Haunting, and also Dr. Menard from Lucio Fulci's Zombie. So there's that. So, because the devil is apparently angry that Dimitri helped this woman get away, Satan makes his car go all zigzaggy when he's driving one day, and the car like goes plunging off a cliff. But then he stops the car in midair, and he offers Dimitri a deal. He says, "You can have another 10 years of life if you help this woman named Jessica deliver a baby at some time in the foreseeable future." Jessica, incidentally, is played by the aforementioned Juliette Mills, who is not only the older sister of Haley Mills, but was also in the 1992 movie Waxwork Lost in Time, among many, many other things, but that's what I had seen her in. Now, presumably, the movie then jumps ahead almost a decade, and we're now in San Francisco, and we're following the Barrett family. So this is Jessica, the mom who we've already met, her husband Robert, who's played by Gabriele Lavia. He was actually in 3 Dario Argento movies, matter of fact. He was in Deep Red, he was in Inferno, and he was in Sleepless as well. Yeah, so those are the parents, and then they have these two weirdo children, their daughter Gail and their son Ken. Now... as this happens in a lot of Italian movies, the dubbing on the kids is pretty atrocious, but the two kids, like the shit that they say, they are like easily the most fruitful source of the movie's intentional comedy. It's not funny usually, but like the kids like say funny shit. Like Gail, who looks like she's about, I can't really tell how old she is, maybe 9, 10, 11, somewhere like that. But she like swears like a sailor and uses like real like... amusingly dated like 70s vernacular like all the time. Like she'll say something like, "You gotta stop that or it's gonna blow my mind, man. You don't quit crying, you're gonna have a real bad trip," and like shit like that. It's like, it's hysterical. Aside from that, like another one of her character traits, which is just like random and hilarious to me, is that she also has this inexplicable obsession with the 1970 novel Love Story by Eric Segal, and she always carries like a dozen new copies of it like wherever she goes, and she's always reading it, and it's just like and they never explain it, and it's just like, that's really, really funny to me. So the younger kid, Ken, who looks about 4 or 5, I guess, he's also a little bit foul-mouthed, and he also, his kind of character trait that defines him is constantly drinking Campbell's pea soup, like right out the can with a straw, which I guess that's like a funny little homage to The Exorcist, but it actually works because hardly anybody in the movie draws attention to it. Like I said, it's just kind of random. Nobody really brings it up. It's just like he's packing a lunchbox and he's putting cans of Campbell's pea soup in it, but nobody says anything about it. You know what I mean? So like that makes it funnier to me that they're not going, "Hey, look, it's a joke." You know what I mean? They're just kind of like letting you pick up on it. So one like small exchange between the two kids that actually legitimately made me laugh out loud when I was watching this movie. It happens like right near the beginning, and the kids are like in the back seat of the family convertible, and they're, you know, the parents are in the front seat, and they're kind of having a conversation, and like the dad's talking about I don't know. He said something about it's like egotistical or something like that. And so the kids are in the back, like kind of talking back and forth about what a loser their dad is. And Gail says to Ken, like the younger kid, "Hey, remember that crazy nickname you gave him? What was that?" And the little kid goes, "Asshole." And it was just like the comic timing of it was just like perfect. And I was just like, just busted up laughing. And sorry, but little kids swearing will never not be hilarious to me. And I don't know why that is. So anyway, we have like some establishing scenes of this very laid back 70s California family. Like the kids call their parents by their first names and are kind of like allowed to, like I said, swear and like pretty much get away with anything. So amidst all of that, we learn that Jessica has just discovered that she's pregnant again. Now, Robert seems ambivalent about this whole situation, as does Jessica, matter of fact. But, you know, I guess they figure they'll deal with things as they happen. They're not going to ride too much of a bummer about it, man. You know what I mean? Like, that's something like Gail would say. But it doesn't take too long for the couple to realize that this isn't any ordinary pregnancy. Now, Jessica insists, "Now, I shouldn't have even have gotten knocked up in the first place because I took the pill religiously, even though I'm like, dude, it's only like 99% effective. That does give a little bit of wiggle room, you know what I mean? And I've known several people that did get pregnant on the pill, so, you know, it's not foolproof. But even barring that, I mean, she tells her doctor, who is also like a family friend, his name is George, who's played by Nino Segarini, actually, that she last had her period like 7 weeks ago, even though the fetus's development, he's like, "I hate to tell you this, but the fetus looks like it's about 3.5 months. So it's like twice as big as it should be." You know, so in other words, the spawn seems to be growing at an abnormally like accelerated rate is what he's saying. So then, like, other weird shit starts happening, too. Like, Robert starts seeing a bearded man, who we actually recognize as Dimitri, but he doesn't know who that is. He starts seeing him around San Francisco, and he appears to be, like, following him. He's, like, sees him. Like, he'd be sitting in a cafe, and then he's sitting over there, like, staring at him and shit like that. He's like, "What the fuck?" You know what I mean? So he's, like, following him around everywhere. The kids start seeing, like, some spooky, like, poltergeist-type activity around the apartment. Like, their toys, their dolls start moving around on their own, and, like, their eyes start glowing and, like, creepy shit like that. Worse than that, though, Jessica seems to be pretty steadily like losing her marbles. I mean, it's like she will act like totally normal 1 minute and then become like a super aggressive rage monster the next minute. Like one day, for example, she heaves like a huge glass ashtray across the apartment, like through Robert's prize aquarium, like killing all the big goldfish in there. Another day, she belts Gail across the mouth, like for being a smartass, even though she'd always been real indulgent before, like kind of let her do it. She wanted. And then one time in George's office, she goes from like literally 1 second, she's like, "I want an abortion. Like, this isn't a good situation. This baby's going to hurt me, blah, blah, blah." And then like the next second, she's like screeching, "I'll kill anybody who tries to take this baby away from me, blah, blah, blah." Like, it's a roller coaster of emotions, that's for sure. So as the movie goes on, Dimitri finally approaches Robert and kind of reveals his identity. Now, 10 years ago, Dimitri says, him and Jessica had a thing. They were in love or whatever. But he kind of says, "Oh, well, I kind of screwed it up and she left," or whatever. He also makes some kind of vague references to some group they were in, which, you know, obviously it's like a satanic cult, right? But he doesn't really say that. And maybe there's like some negative energies, man, and stuff like that. And all of this might have something to do with the baby in Jessica's womb. He tells Robert that Jessica has to have the baby and she has to have it at home. Under no circumstances, take her to the hospital. So Robert doesn't believe him at first, but soon enough, like, Jessica starts exhibiting some very, very Reagan McNeil type behavior, you know, spewing green bile all over the place, speaking in growly voices, levitating. There's actually like a really cool scene where she's like standing upright and like levitating a few feet off the floor like that. It's like, it's really well done. And also causing some very violent, like paranormal disruptions around the apartment, like shit flying around, everything like that. Finally, Robert decides he's going to allow Dimitri into their house to help with Jessica against Dr. George's wishes, I might add, as Dimitri really seems to be the only person with any clue of what the fuck is going on here. Interestingly, though, unlike The Exorcist, there isn't really any exorcism in this movie. Like, no exorcism takes place. Yes, Jessica is evidently possessed by the devil, and yes, Dimitri does know what's going on and is at her bedside, like sparring kind of with the entity that's possessing her, like in a similar way as you see in The Exorcist. But in this case, Dimitri is actually not really a good guy. So it's not like it's not like good versus evil. It's kind of like super evil versus slightly less evil and also kind of dumb. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of situation. It's implied, actually, that Dimitri is either already dead or at least is in some kind of, like, limbo pending the outcome of the deal that he made with the devil. Because remember, like I said, he left the car, like, suspended. See, the Prince of Darkness, you'll remember, gave him 10 more years if he would facilitate this birth. And it's hinted that now that the 10 years is almost up, the devil is going to let Dimitri's soul be reborn in Jessica's baby. So that's why he's so, like, head up to get in there and, like, help out with the birth and everything like that. There's even a great scene, too, where, like, pregnant Jessica is, like, floats up, like, a few feet, and she's talking, like, in the growly devil voice or whatever, and she's, like, telling Dimitri to, like, basically, like, ram his hands up there and pull the thing out. You know what I mean? Which, I don't know, that amused me, too. However, poor, stupid Dimitri apparently forgot that one of Satan's other appellations is the father of lies, and is therefore shocked, I tell you, when the devil says to him, essentially, no, I was just fucking with you. I'm not really gonna let your soul be reborn in the baby. And he's just like, psych, and then he just lets the car that was suspended for 10 years, I'm presuming, and nobody saw it all that time. I'd say it's supernatural, I'm not gonna worry about it. But he just, like, lets the car, like, fall to the bottom of the canyon, like, into the ocean. It's just like, sucks for you, you're dead now, Dimitri, haha. You know what I mean? So he lied to him about all of that just so he could get him there to do whatever. Basically, the devil just said, I was just doing it to fuck with you. Like, he didn't need him there or nothing like that. He was just doing it because he thought it would be funny and, like, to amuse himself for shits and giggles, essentially. He has the Jessica's baby is born, but then he causes it to be stillborn, and also it doesn't have a mouth because, you know, he's the devil and he's kind of a dick like that. And then, like, at the very end, the final shot has, like, a seemingly recovered Jessica. I guess, like, the devil got bored of being in there. Like, once the baby was born, it's like, bye, I'm out. You know what I mean? I'm going to go possess somebody else now. I'm going to go over to Regan McNeil's house, see what she's up to. So, yeah. So she looks like she's, you know, she's still kind of fucked up, but she looks like she's better. And so she's on the boat, and Robert's on the boat, and their two kids are on the boat. They look like they're on vacation or some shit like that. And then, Ken, the little boy, he opens this present, which actually I thought was kind of cool, because you see the mom, Jessica, like, give Ken this gift, like, at the beginning, because, like, it's his birthday, like, at the very beginning, they have, like, a little birthday party and stuff, and she gives him this present that's wrapped in, like, black paper with, like, gold ribbons on it and stuff, but he doesn't open it, like, at the party, because, like, some other shit happens, so at the very end, like, she gives it to him, and he's opening it, and inside, there's, like, a toy red car that looks like the car that Dimitri got killed in. And then, so Ken takes the little car and then just takes it to the edge of the boat and, like, chucks it into the ocean. And then, like, he turns around and then, like, he has, like, scary contact lenses in, like, so you're led to presume that Ken is now possessed because reasons. So I guess, like, the devil didn't go to Regan McNeil's house. I guess he just went, like, hopped over. And he's like, the devil got lazy, you know what I mean? He's just like, well, I just been in this pregnant lady, like, all this time. And it's like, I think I'm just going to, like, hop over here, like, into the next room, like, into this little kid. This should be a fun time. So that's what he did. So I guess, like, the kid's supposed to be possessed now. Now, I have to say, like, Beyond the Door wasn't actually the only Italian Exorcist knockoff. Hell, it wasn't even the only one that came out in 1974. There was another one that came out in 1974 called The Antichrist, which was directed by Alberto DiMartino, and I haven't actually seen that one. I've heard it's pretty good, though, so I'll probably, like, get around to it. But, you know, Beyond the Door, like, I have to admit, even though, like I said, this one gets, like, generally pretty negative reviews, but I kind of had a soft spot for this one. It's not a great film, I'm not gonna say that. It's not a lost gem or nothing, but it's kind of like a cool, like, a strange little artifact of the era, I guess. It's got, like, some really, really, like, head-scratching scenes in it. Like, there's one scene, and it's long. It's, like, this extended sequence where Robert is walking down a San Francisco street being accosted by a man who's, like, playing a recorder, like, or some kind of flute or something like that, like, with his nose. And it's, there's no dialogue or anything like that. He's just, like, walking down the street, and there's, like, musicians, like, walking along behind him going, hey, fucking with him. And it goes on for, like, forever. And then there's, like, this weird, like, jazz fusion kind of shit going on. So this guy's just, like, playing the flute with his nose, and I'm just like, alrighty. So I don't know what that was about. It's just, like, weird scenes like that in there. It also has, like, some really decent special effects. They're very, very simple. Like, there's no you know, there's nothing like super like over the top or anything like that. I mean, mostly it's just like puking up green stuff. And but there is one really great scene, and it was done like really simple with like split screen, but it still looks really good, where Jessica is like laying down in the bed. And, like, one of her eyes is, like, you know, just doing normal eye shit. And then the other one is just, like, rolling, like, all crazy, like, all around. And it looks, like, really disquieting. But, because I'm looking at it going, how the fuck did they do that? And then I was like, oh, I guess it was split screen. But, like, the way that they did it, like, you couldn't really tell. So it looked, like, really eerie. Like, it looked really creepy. But, like I said, it's really, really simply done. They could do that back in the silent movie era. So, you know what I mean? So it's not, like I said, it's very simple, but very, very effective. And like I said, the score of this is, like, really interesting, too. It's very obtrusive and kind of skronky, but I don't know. I kind of dug it, like, for all that. Now, as I mentioned before, like, some of the scenes go on way too long and feature, like, way too much repeated dialogue. Like, there's one phone call, and this happens, like, multiple times, but there's one phone call, like, after Jessica breaks Robert's aquarium, like, the fish tank. She's talking to him on the phone, and she keeps saying, it wasn't an accident. I wanted to break it. It wasn't an accident. I wanted to break it. I wanted to break it. I wanted to break it. I was just like, shut up. Oh my God. I just wanted to like smack her. Okay. You wanted to break it. We get it. She said it like six times. And I was just kind of like, oh my God. But there was, that happened like a few times throughout the movie. I'm like, man, you could have like taken 20 minutes out of the movie right there just by like having each line of dialogue just said one time. And then, you know, it would have been a lot shorter. And like I said, there's really no gore. There's like no big, it's not like, you know, Lucio Fulci or like a lot of Italian movies from this time period where they like went over the top, like with the guts and blood and everything. There's hardly any gore in this that I can even remember. Very, very little nudity. I think there was, maybe she was naked at the beginning, but it was kind of dark and you couldn't really see anything. So there wasn't like any tits or nothing like that. I mean, if that's what you're into. But I'm just saying that like exploitation cinema from this era, like usually would have a lot of that, and this doesn't have any of that. But I'm going to say if you're into Italian cinema and possession movies from the 1970s, if you're into giallo movies, you might be into this too, even though, like I said, it's not gory and it's not like murders or anything like that, but it kind of has more of a vibe of a giallo movie than it does like a straight outright like possession horror movie, if that makes any sense. But if you're into that kind of stuff, then you might want to give it a look. But let me know if you've seen it and what you thought about it. If you've seen any other Exorcist ripoffs that you could recommend to me, then I would appreciate that as well. And that'll do it for this movie retrospective. I'll see you guys again on the next one. Bye.